I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. Have you ever seen an avalanche in real life?
Yes.
Like coming down a mountain?
Yes, but yeah, have you? Kind of far away.
Okay, so have you been where the earth is trembling and you can...
No.
It's so loud you can't hear anything else. In that moment, it's just like your body is taken over by sheer fear and anxiety. And I think this is what a lot of people... including myself, by the way, kind of experience when you wake up to what is going on to our climate and to our planet. This is the avalanche.
That is a great metaphor.
Thank you. But he has never been in an avalanche.
Well, in that case, you know, when you're feeling so paralyzed at that avalanche, I mean, you're just, your body is taking over, right? What do you do? How do you move forward and get into action? And actually, that's what this episode is about. In this episode, we're speaking with Patrick Kennedy Williams and Megan Kennedy Woodard, two psychologists who have opened a practice focused on turning climate anxiety into sustainable action.
Take a listen.
Hello, I'm Megan Kennedy Woodard. I'm a coaching psychologist and co-founder of Climate Psychologists.
This is me, Patrick Kennedy Williams, also co-director of Climate Psychologists and partner of Megan.
And we are also the authors of Turn the Tide on Climate Anxiety, Sustainable Action for Your Mental Health and the Planet.
So we are for the first time a professional and personal couple being interviewed by a professional and personal couple.
Yes, we're a very rare breed. Those of us who choose to spend our lives together in work and play, I guess is the way to say it. So, let's get started. What exactly is climate psychology? I assume you kind of are the people who define it. What is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's as you might imagine, given the growing focus, rightly so, on the climate emergency, climate psychology is growing as a field in response to and in accordance with that. So, climate psychology is incredibly broad. We might be talking about the interaction between climate change and our mental health. We might be talking about how we communicate about climate change and about the climate crisis. We might be talking about transition, like transition within governments, transition within companies, and can transition in our communities and how best to do that. And so I suppose climate psychology, we're biased, of course, being psychologists, but we like to think that we have a role to play in all these different areas, you know. A lot of what we talk about, Megan and I, is more around the intersection between mental health and the climate crisis, I would say. Our book's all about that. But we touch on these other areas as well, particularly communication.
So first of all, what drove you to enter this field personally? And then what are you seeing as far as trends in terms of psychological impact of climate change?
So it all sort of happened quite organically. We had a sort of traditional psychological practice in Oxford, England, where we were treating a range of mental health disorders like anxiety, depression, OCD, health anxiety, things like that. And Patrick has a clinical psychology background, and I'm a coach. And so from this, just within our community, we started to engage more with the climate emergency. I was taking my children to climate clubs, and at the same time, I sort of noticed that the parents of the children there were really anxious, really concerned, really unsure about how to approach conversations about climate change with their kids, managing their own worries and their own fears about it, and then also how to take action as a family in a way that, you know, they weren't burning out or they weren't shutting off. Around the same time, I started to learn more and more about the science behind what's happening. A friend of mine's an activist and invited me along to a meeting it was Extinction Rebellion at the time, and I started to see sort of the protests, and it really hit me personally in a way that I think I experienced what would you describe as sort of eco grief, where I just really felt this deep sorrow for what was happening. And then I reminded myself I'm a coach and I need to not just sit on the couch and worry about it. And sort of at the same time, Patrick had his first sort of our patient zero, if he'll forgive us the term, come in. And this person was a researcher. He was finding that he was unable to concentrate, not engage, withdraw. And he was a climate scientist. And from this, we sort of noticed more and more that this was an issue that the services weren't necessarily apparent on what to do. The support wasn't available and people weren't talking about it enough and feeling really isolated. So from there, we developed tools and programs and workshops, and we really wanted to just move as many people from experiencing these feelings like anxiety, depression, anger, fear, to sort of harness the power of those because they're really helpful, but then move them into a place of more positive, sustainable action.
It was kind of clear, wasn't it, at that time that there was going to be more of this. You know, when like Megan said, when that first client walked through the door, it really made me think, we're not equipped. This is going to happen more and more. More of these people are experiencing it. They're at the coalface of the changes that are happening at a planetary climate level. And this is not going to be an isolated thing. You know, it was clear to us then, actually, we need to be, you know, we need to be working out more and more about what these people need, what, you know, what the risks are, and how to support people. Yeah,
exactly. Because it's really hard to escape. You know, it's really hard to escape on social media, on television, even walking down the beach. Very hard to escape climate change these days. You know, and then coming back to what Megan just said, you know, when you said you developed workshops and courses and all that, I wonder, is it to solve your own mental, well, you said mental health, like solving my own anxiety, or is it solving climate change, and how is this interconnected?
The wonderful thing is they support each other. We know that that a certain amount of climate anxiety can actually be quite motivating for people to engage with climate action. And, you know, that might be, it looks different for everyone. You know, that might be on a very personal level, reconnecting with nature more. That might be channeling real eco rage into systems change. And so we all have sort of this part to play in it. And it's really wonderful because helping people connect with their emotions allows them to find their purpose in the climate action that they want to take whilst relieving their climate anxiety, but also supporting you know, what we need to do for the planet.
You know, it is even that prospect of feeling hopeful, you know, in the context of all the things you can do, right? You can join a march, you can recycle, you can do systemic change, as, you know, we're kind of focused on that level of it. How do you, you know, that in itself is overwhelming, I feel. Like, what do I do is even as overwhelming as, oh my gosh, the planet is really coming to a terrible place. But what do you find the most comforting for people, you know, other than just connecting with each other around that anxiety? What types of pathways is, you know, brings people most comfort or most satisfaction?
Well, you've touched on a fundamental one, and that's the connectivity with others. Because what we find is that there's been real, and this is a completely purposeful impression that we have that this is on us as individuals to stop. And that has happened through huge disinformation campaigns, corporations and governments saying, oh, what can you do, when actually they should be responsible for the big changes that need to happen. So firstly, by connecting with others, it reminds us that we're shoulder to shoulder with so many people doing so much incredible work. And we want to move from that place of overwhelm where we feel like, oh, there's so much I need to do, there's so much I should be doing, not enough's being done, that kind of scarcity place, to a place of more abundance. Look at all these people around us who are doing all this amazing work and all the opportunities and all the solutions. So it's really re-engaging with that. So that's the connectivity thing that I think, you know, you first sort of touched on, but actually that's the launch off point, I think. And from there, we can each find our individual pathway. And it just comes with that, what's important to me, what's easy for me, where can I have the biggest impact?
We do a lot of work with people who might come with that very same question, right? They're aware of the need and the urgency. And they say, well, where on earth do I start with all of this? Because there are, like I said, we're always being told about all the things that we can do. And no one person is going to be able to do all of these things. And actually, we all have our own strengths. You know, we talk in the book about a framework of kind of three different areas just to help people start to kind of navigate their way to answering that question. What, you know, what's my role in this? And we talk about these areas being impact. You know, think about, well, where can I have the greatest impact And we get them to think about meaning. Actually, where do my values really reside in this? What do I really care about? You know, we call them objects of care. You know, the things that really resonate to us. Is it about renewable energy for you? Is it about conservation? Is it about climate justice and sort of the intersectional climate justice movement? Is it about standing up for the rights of underprivileged people? All of this has a part to play, but which one really resonates for you? And then the third area is ease. You know, actually lean into what you're good at, where your talents are. You know, start with the easiest changes to make. Exactly as Megan said, we shouldn't feel like this is all on our shoulders, but we should nonetheless feel empowered that we all have a role to play, you know, and we can't all try to do everything, you know.
Right, and I guess a huge part in this is also a communication, you know, because it is I feel it's very... sometimes very easy, like with you guys, very easy to connect, you know, kind of on the same plane. And with other people, it's so difficult to even start a conversation, yeah, about serious issues, about, you know, what needs to change. And then I think more and more we end up in these kind of black and white areas or blue and red or whatever you want to call it, you know, whatever level it's on. So I guess anyways, it's just
actually that's a really good point. And I wonder if you have observed, is there a correlation in terms of the polarity that we're experiencing in the world and the anxiety? Do both sides of that polarity share an anxiety about climate change, or is there more of a kind of, is it really more correlated to kind of a denial versus a panic? I mean, like, is there some pattern there that we could learn from?
Do you want to go ahead? You can start if you want, but I have my own ideas.
No, go ahead, go on.
So again, I think we're talking about denial, which is a psychological response. And for some people, the climate crisis is just too big to engage with. It's too invasive on the life that they know and enjoy, too many changes to make. It's too big, too far away, not going to affect me. There's that level of denial. And then we say that actually a little bit of denialism helps us as activists and people that are highly engaged with the climate change actually get out of bed in the morning. So a tiny bit is actually helpful. But then there's, again, that sense of denialism, which is the structures that put in place and really push up that polarity, encourage that polarity. And it's so systemically deep in lobbying, in disinformation campaigns from the fossil fuels industry, that I think we need to actually, when we go into those conversations with people, hold a space for compassion, that they kind of are victims of this huge disinformation campaign, and we need to actually find common ground and try to signal what's important to us and see what's important to them and what we share. Often there's a great cartoon that says, what, you know, it's what we need to do, you know, take out plastics from the oceans, cut fossil fuels, make the world more just, make the world more fair. And then someone in the back saying, but what if we do all this and climate change is just a hoax? It's like, well, then we've just made the world a much better place. And so, you know, often with someone that doesn't believe in climate change, I'll say, oh, you know, I love going on the beach. It drives me nuts. There was so much plastic the other day and I just had to start picking it up. And they say, oh, I hate that too. I do the same thing. It just drives me nuts. And actually we've suddenly connected on something. I think David Attenborough is something everybody loves. So, you know, we have these places to kind of launch off these connections and bring space into that polarity.
Yeah, I'll speak to that last point Megan made about David Attenborough. So in the US, there's the Yale Center for Climate Communication has been doing a lot of work on like charting American attitudes to climate change. And what they're finding, which is a picture around the world, is that those who are disengaged or deny is just that proportionally shrinking over time, and people are becoming more alert, more engaged, more ready for change. The similar thing's been happening in the UK as well. There was a great program of research called Britain Talks Climate, which was kind of really harking back to that point you made about kind of, you know, how do we talk about this? You know, some conversations go really well. That's probably because we might share similar ideas and values. Other conversations are more difficult. How do you find that common ground in a polarized world? And so what Britain Talks Climate was looking at was saying, actually, where are the areas of contact and connection? And Megan saying David Attenborough wasn't just the kind of a whimsical thing to say. Actually, he was the kind of, if you like, the sort of bastion that would, around which all of these different sort of socio-political groups could come together and say, actually, yeah, we really trust this guy. You know, that's probably why he's become such a powerful figure in the climate movement, is because he manages to transcend these kind of different socio-political groups in the UK. And it really speaks to this idea of, it's not just the message, it's the messenger.
That's really interesting, because he really comes from a love of nature. You know, it's just a complete adoration and love of nature without any politics at all in the first place, right?
It does sort of reemphasize how important it is to deliver climate communication that is solution focused, personally focused. The narrative needs to not be far away, distant images of things that scorched earth, things like that. People don't want to engage with that, but people will be much more likely to engage with personal success stories or community success stories. And these can be technological, these can be socioeconomical, these can be gender and LGBTQ based. You know, it's like that we can find the intersectionalism of all of this and start telling those stories. That's when it'll become a space where more people can come together and connect.
I think there's also, in terms of climate communication, it's helpful to sort of debunk the myth that you have to completely change somebody's mind if you talk about climate change and the climate crisis with them. You know, actually, this is what we're doing is it's a slow sort of stepwise process of people coming around to a new idea and a new reality. And for some people, they're deeply engaged already. For others, it just takes a little bit of time. But I think we've kind of, it's one of those sort of dinner table conversations that we don't talk politics, don't talk climate. We need to be having these conversations as best we can. There's a Matt Winning, who's a sort of a comedian and a climate researcher, which is an amazing combination in the UK. He says, well, it's a national pastime to talk about the weather. Why are we so afraid about talking about the climate, you know? This is the big shift. It's one of the most impactful things we can do as individuals, is to talk about it more and to overcome those kind of barriers. Yes, it might be awkward. We might not change that person's mind, but actually that's okay. You know, it's in the national and international conversation now in a very real way. And that's kind of where it needs to be, you know.
You were mentioning that the messenger seems to make a difference, like who delivers the message actually has an impact on how it lands to the listener. And you mentioned David Attenborough, but what are there other celebrities, or is that a potential strategy that we could find people that, like Oprah's out there in the world that everyone adores, and how to make climate their number one issue? Or how could we leverage that knowledge somehow?
It's already happening, I would say. We've done some work with broadcasters in the UK about this, you know, and about how to write climate change stories into drama, into TV drama, or you know, obviously we've had Don't Look Up these past few months coming out, which is, you know, is a huge sort of metaphorical kind of flag in the sand in terms of the climate crisis, again using humour and pastiche kind of thing. We've got sports broadcasters as well about whether they can use kind of sports personalities to talk about the climate crisis. Yeah, this is all happening. Yeah,
I think but at the end of sort of consulting for those groups, what we realized is actually there's always the opportunity to bring in some sort of message about climate action, whether that's someone drinking out of a bottle of water and saying, oh, why do you have a bottle of water, and you know, checking it out, or you know, it's like actually there's always the opportunity there. There's a great woman, a writer and an activist named Marianne Bonneau, and she's the zero waste chef, and she has a great saying of, people don't just stop using plastic straws and stop there. It sort of snowballs. And so actually getting someone to think for the first time about climate change, well, suddenly they might go home and be a little bit more conscious about their waste, or buy a little less plastic, or, you know, it's I always use my dad as the example, because he's this typical wonderful, like, American guy who loves his steak and loved his SUV. And I, you know, rather than, you know, telling him over and over again, actually, the diesel industry is terrible. And, you know, I just started talking about how great our electric car was and how awesome it is. And then he was like, oh, really interested. And so then he ended up getting an electric car. And he, you know, then Patrick started talking about his, how our garden's so great since we started composting. And now he's got a composter and he's this activist and never knew it. But suddenly, you know, he's hyped into it. He's got solar panels. He's telling his neighbors about it. And so it, you know, it's just, it's that sort of sell on a personal level. But again, talking at dinner parties about how great it is, it's not something you have to give up. Something that you enjoy doing and something that's helping your daily life.
Yeah, I mean, maybe a little bit off topic, actually not, but, you know, I just woke up, so I just checked my news, right, and woke up to these news about the war in Ukraine at the moment and how more and more, especially American companies, are basically pulling out to services in Russia. And I don't want to go into Russia and Ukraine at all, right? It's just interesting how all of a sudden not only governments but also corporations like switch off services and kind of force, I guess it's some sort of, you know, enforcement to, that's not okay, you know, to invade another country. And I wonder if we could do the same, if corporations could do the same. I mean, they have so much economic power, yeah, sometimes more than governments these days. If the same thing could happen on climate change.
Well, I think we've already started to see in the trickle effects of this, because every business now needs some sort of sustainable to net zero plan. And what we want to be really careful of is that greenwashing doesn't occur. But we've seen how what can happen if supply and demand. So actually, this is where the demand has really kicked into gear in, you know, companies that are pulling out of Russia are going to be, you know, much more well received by the consumer than those who have decided to stay in. In fact, they might be blacklisted if they do. So they're picking up on those cues and they're stepping back voluntarily and they're adjusting to the market's demand. And absolutely we can do that with green energy, but what we need to do is we need to start showing how much money is available to be, and I'm not saying do business as usual, but starting to say, actually, there is so much to be had here, so many jobs that could be created through green energy, and so much wealth that could be accumulated, but then it could be redistributed in a way that we haven't done before, where actually it really embeds this, you know, this much more sustainable economy that is more equal, because, you know, we can see how fast those oligarchs are running. You know, it's like, actually, we can pull that back and make the fossil fuel industries respond too.
You know, I hear both messages. One message is, you know, speak about the positive successes and share, you know, share our impact, share the success that we are having as individuals. And then this other message of kind of hold government and corporations accountable through our pocketbooks and through our language. And as psychologists in this field, I wonder if you come across people who are conflicted in their minds as corporate leaders, so to speak, who have to make these decisions based on, you know, their personal values, but also the advancement of the corporation. You know, I think one of the reasons we're in this trouble that we're in is because corporations actually incentivize people to knowingly make decisions against the interest of themselves as individuals, or as against at least others as individuals. They may get the payment for making those horrible decisions. But have you come across people who have actually grappled with this question?
Yeah, I definitely have. I'm sure Megan has as well. And that's a horrible dilemma to have, where you're torn between, you know, between profit for the company and your own personal value system. And actually, you know, there are, you know, and increasingly, there are people at the top who you know, really wrestle with that conflict. Yeah, and there's, in sort of go down the sort of capitalism loophole, but there is absolutely a tension there between growth and net zero. In some cases, as Megan said, not in all cases, because there's plenty of opportunity for those two things to coexist.
So what do you do? What do you do as psychologists to support that or to help resolve that conflict? How would you approach it?
Yeah, I mean, depending on the organization, you know, it's about all these conversations that we've had today about communication. you know, this applies within organizations as well. Actually, if this matters and you're in a position of influence in the organization, we can go in and say, actually, this is if this is how we need to be communicating about the changes that need to happen and why, and about framing it in terms of opportunity rather than risk for the company. Other ways, you know, for people who you know, experience that tension and need something in the meantime, it's about saying, okay, well, what can you be doing outside of your 9 to 5 in order to be maximizing your personal impact? Are there other projects, as long as you don't, you know, burn out trying to do too much, you know, trying to do too much during the day and night, but actually saying if there's some way that that can be remedied in the short term, then it's helpful. And then, you know, any way of just getting those changes into the organization whilst working within that system is helpful. But a lot of it is about communication, particularly in the company. Yeah.
Well, we're, you know, want to kind of continue on the issue of the corporate conflict, because we all know that some of these, the majority of these problems kind of come from corporate action. And one of the questions we have is, have you come across, or how do you deal with eco-guilt? Is that something that you find from, like, in a previous interview, we had someone talk about the elite polluters, those who are billionaires now, they can pollute all they want, because they're going to survive in their minds, and the rest of us are inconsequential. But there's also others who feel really guilty, and how would you advise them as a psychologist?
I love a little bit of guilt because I'm Catholic once removed. So I think guilt in the context of sort of us as individuals is something that we can nod to without bowing to it, because what we need to do is we need to release guilt. This isn't something that we've created. This isn't something that, you know, we're part of the system, like, as we've talked about, but we can also use guilt as a really helpful sort of flashlight onto our values, what's important for us. So for me, if, you know, if I know that I could easily walk somewhere, I'll walk there, because I really, you know, I know that that's one way that I can immediately just, you know, check that off my box. Or I'm very happy to go much less meat because that's something that's important to me, animal welfare, all of that. So it shines a light on what's important to us. So that's where guilt is really helpful. Again, we've talked about sort of the, you know, the 1% polluters. There's certainly people that could use a little bit more guilt in their life, I think. but with that, I'd also like to really emphasize that I don't believe in guilt shaming, because I think that that is actually a deterrent in people wanting to take more action. So people that are doing their best, but then they get to the dinner party and someone says, oh, you didn't bring a vegan dish. You know, that can be really off-putting for people. Or, oh, how did you get here? Oh, well, we flew here because I haven't seen my parents in a year and a half. It's like, actually, we need to again sort of remove that, because then people are going to feel less engaged, or that they're not doing enough. And that's not fair. But again, we can sort of look to those 1% and encourage them to feel a little bit more guilt, a little bit more cause for humanity as a whole.
But yeah, it's really interesting, this idea of guilt existing within a corporation. Mm. You know, what does corporate guilt look like? And not as in a corporation is guilty of X, Y, and Z actions, but actually that kind of that eco guilt residing in a company. And it's sort of that it's that dissonance idea, isn't it? The problems, that discomfort that can occur when we know that our actions are in some way separated from what we know we should be doing, you know, and how that, you know, how that might exist in companies. And you know, I think it's a really important question. Certainly, we sort of love to go in and coach with organizations around how to kind of take those measurable steps to reduce that dissonance and therefore reduce the guilt as well. But Megan, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a flashlight on your values. If you're feeling guilty, the first question to ask actually, but why am I feeling this guilt? What am I doing that might need to change?
Well, I think we're, you know, I think you've given so many great ways that we can deal with our anxiety around climate change. And the connection to other humans and their concern is certainly a big one. And I wonder if there's a lot much that you can speak to in terms of our connection to nature and how that actually impacts our mental health, whether we're in a corporation or as individuals. We hear it over and over again that when you connect with nature, it really does do something to your mental health. And have you had that experience as well?
Absolutely. You know, that sort of is the next part of self-care, and that moves us into really connecting with nature. This sort of ecotherapy that can happen is, you know, there's so many great examples from around the world. There's forest bathing, which is a wonderful way to reconnect. And actually, I think it's important that we sort of go back a step and look at how there's so many amazing cultures that have really been the first to hit or to have climate change hit them, who have been engaging with with that connection with nature that sort of us in the Western world have really detached from. And I think that that makes it all the more important that we, acknowledge their, what they're going through, being impacted, but also having more deep connections than we've allowed ourselves to detach from. And so moving into that kind of ecotherapy that can be, actually doing conservation work in nature, which can be really restorative and making us feel like our actions are supporting our immediate surroundings and feeling a real protection for nature.
No, I actually agree. You know, there's a certain disconnect to nature, but I do think has also become a privilege to have a connection with nature. You know, and I think that is the underlying problem in our society or modern society, that it is a privilege to go out into nature, to experience unpolluted nature. And we all know, you know, from scientific research, etc., that the climate change actually hits the ones who have marginalized communities and poor communities first. And so this access to then the privilege to, oh, beautiful nature, you know, is very hard. It's very hard. It's kind of pointing for me, it's always pointing to the same thing. It's time. How much time are we running out of time? There's a huge time pressure, I guess we have. And then we had one of our last episodes, we had a Russian scientist, and he had this wonderful way of laying out climate change in these three phases. And apart from my managing my own overwhelm and my own anxiety about this, you know, it became so clear that this whole pollution and the whole deterioration of our planet has actually accelerated so much faster than it was anticipated. And it's now basically the decade we can make a decision as humanity, right? And where are you guys in this?
The important thing to say about the role and presence of climate anxiety is that it's probably not going to go away. And actually, you know, and for anyone out there who's experiencing climate anxiety, I think, you know, you use the word solved there. I'd say in some respects, we should move away from thinking of it as something that needs to be overcome or something that needs to be solved, and actually probably accept the fact that there is going to be a lot of distress around the changes that are happening. And actually, we need to be able to talk about that as something that is going to exist rather than something we need to sort of rush to fit. We spoke today about how a little bit of climate anxiety is helpful, a little bit of guilt, eco-guilt is helpful, etc. And that will continue to be the case. And I think we have to kind of say, actually, this isn't something that we need to put in a box and put away.
I see our role sort of in the near future is that we want to keep those working in sustainability sustained. So keeping them really able to engage and not burning out, whilst also paying special focus on supporting those who are more and more directly impacted, and making sure that communication is very strategic in getting more and more people on board.
I think like the climate of the beautiful planet that we live on, it's about balance.
Is there anything you would like to add or like to reach out to people personal message or anything you would really like to bring out?
I think it really always comes down to that, finding our role, finding our purpose in this. So look to your values, look where you can have that biggest impact and what it means to you. And make sure it's easy and fun too. Enjoy the work that you do. It is possible to access those positive eco emotions. So motivation, connection, you know, optimism with action.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.